This is Ms. Jeet with Telling Tales Here Tonight at 104.3 KTOO in Juneau. And I have a story for you. It's called The Battery. It's by Rumor. So, let's get started. Ah, Halloween, October 31st. It is my favorite night of the year. Children and teens roaming, some unattended, through the streets, walking up to strangers' very doors. What a trusting society. Naive and trusting. It's cute, really. It has been raining all day, but finally lets up just before 4:30 in the afternoon, which is nice. It means that the sky is already dark, so that when the sun finally sets, there will be no light. Oh, but it is perfect. My kind of night. At 5, the children dress themselves in their various outfits, some colorful and some gruesome. I see a fairy walking in a group with a robot made of cardboard boxes and a werewolf that reminds me of the old horror movies with men in furry costumes. A little 7-year-old zombie painted with green skin is trailing behind with his mother. I walk the streets, smiling at the children passing me and at the parents who stare with a suspicious gaze that only widens my grin until they can look no more. Who can blame them for staring, really, when I am the one walking through the streets unabashedly watching their children? I feel the twinges of their uneasiness. Not quite fear, but not quite a right feeling either. Dark falls and older children come out to play. I see a group of teens walking the streets laughing to each other. Two pretty young girls, perhaps 16 years old, and a boy of the same age. One girl is dressed in a classic witch costume, complete with a wide-brimmed cone hat. She carries a foot-long stick in one hand and a plastic cauldron in the other, already with a few pieces of candy rattling in the bottom. The other girl is wearing a flowing green dress and brown boots with flowery jewelry adorning her neck and wrists. Her ears are pointed. She carries a pillowcase in one hand. The boy is in a black robe and cloak, carrying a fake scythe and wearing black gloves with skeletal hands on the backs and a skull mask over his face. They interested me, this group. I began to follow them. It isn't like they will be able to see me in the darkness, anyhow. They wander for hours, going from house to house until trick-or-treating itself is over, and then returning to the boy's home. Remaining in costume, though, the boy sheds his mask. They hung out in the backyard of the boy's house. A field, almost a plain, is spread out before them as they sit beneath a tree on a picnic table. A few hundred feet out, the backs of other houses are visible. The children sort out their candy by the light of a few flashlights, first throwing the sweets into two piles, safe and unsafe. When that is done, what they condone as safe is split between them, traded and playfully fought over. I like these children. It's all very tragic, then, that I must do what I do and be what I am. Willing myself, my material form, that is, to dissipate, I reemerge with the shadows of the night. My senses expand beyond anything a human could understand. I feel everything, hear everything, see everything. I find a branch on the ground and break it, producing a loud, sharp, abrasive snap that seems to echo in the night. What was that? The elf asks, head jerking surprisingly quickly to the location of the sound. Probably just a raccoon, the witch tells her. You scared? She's always scared, the reaper mocks. I am not, the elf returns defensively. Yeah, you are. Look at you. The reaper says and adds in a deeper voice, but you know, it is Halloween. I bet there are werewolves out there right now waiting to eat us. Stop it, the elf says in a shrill voice. Her delicate little blonde eyebrows had developed a wrinkle between them and her lip trembled. I scoff at the boy's comment. Werewolves don't prowl around this close to human neighborhoods. at least not if they're in control of themselves. With a thin black tentacle, I gently brush the elf's exposed ankle. She lets out a shriek and nimbly jumps up onto the top of the wooden picnic table, legs pulled up with her. "What's the matter?" the witch asks in alarm, standing up. The reaper simply looks at her with a raised eyebrow. "Something touched me," the elf tells them. "Like what?" the reaper asks. "Like I would know," she shouts and tentatively looks down, aiming one of the flashlight beams at the dark beneath the table. Of course, she sees nothing as the shadows, my shadows, bend around the light. "It felt like a snake or something," the elf says miserably, itching the place I'd swept the tentacle across her skin. "Well, it doesn't look like there's anything now," the reaper says, also looking around them. "I bet it was probably just some wet grass." The elf doesn't say anything further on the matter, but refuses to come down from the tabletop. Oh, the fear. Her fear is now palpable in the air. I can feel it. I can taste it. A demon of lust, a succubus, incubus, relies on the energy produced by lust. I rely upon this fear. I need more. Hunger awakened, I begin my attack in earnest. They can't escape me. "Hey, I think the flashlights need new batteries. Look, do they seem darker to you guys?" "Weird," the reaper says, tapping one flashlight to the tabletop. "I just put new batteries in these before we left. I'll go see if my mom's got any extras." "Travis, I can't see your house." The trio looks toward the general direction the house is in and nervously slide away from the table, grabbing up the dimming flashlights and pointing them the same way. Of course, they can no longer see the house or any other houses. Only my impenetrable darkness. They are in my territory now, and they will feed me well. "I can't see anything. Actually, I can't see anything," the witch cries. "Me neither," the elf shouts, head whipping wildly around, desperate to see something, anything. "What the hell?" the reaper questions. The reaper takes up a stick from the ground and hurls it at the dark wall of my shadows. Those same shadows consume it entirely. The group watches this with growing horror. What an enticing aroma. "Let's get out of here," the elf shouts, now panting heavily with fear and clinging to the reaper's arm. "Okay," he agrees, and they begin to walk, uncertainly, towards where they assumed the house would be. But they would never find it. I wrap one of my tendrils around the elf's ankle and pull her to the ground, screaming all the while, her friends whirling around and holding their flashlights like weapons. I release the elf, and she scrambles to her feet, still screaming, even when she securely has her hands clasped onto her friend's costumes. They run now into my darkness, deeper into my shadow world. The landscape is no longer all black. They can see the houses in the distance, the picnic table, the tree. But those things are gray and colorless, always far away, no matter how fast they run. And the light is as though it is coming from within those unreachable objects. "Oh, God, what's going on?" the witch screams. "What pulled her to the ground?" the reaper nearly screams back. "I don't know. I don't know. We have to get out of here." But there is nowhere to run. And with time, they come to understand. And I feed on that fear. That absolute terror of the inescapable. "Are you having fun yet?" they all scream when I ask. "I know I am. Your fear is so delectable." The boy shouts a few more expletives and throws his nearly lightless flashlight spinning into the dark. I grab him up with one of my tentacles, my true form now showing. I see that the elf has broken down into wordless sobs, covering her eyes with her hands. The witch, meanwhile, seems angry and rushes at me, raising her flashlight as a sword, shouting. The reaper struggles against the strong grip of the black tendrils, sprouting from my vaguely man-shaped form. The witch takes a swing at me with the flashlight, which I easily swipe aside with another of my extra limbs. I grab her up as well. I bring the reaper to me, pinning him to my front and folding him in my arms. He cries out as he feels himself merging with me, as my shadows fold into him, my form overtaking his own. He feels the most intense, wonderful fear. I know this isn't a painful experience, but the terror is enough for the panic shrieks escaping his mouth. When it is done, I hear the witch screaming and grin, doing the same to her as I had done to her reaper companion only moments previously. I bring her into myself and feel her soul shivering within my being, producing that life-sustaining, fear-filled energy I must have or die. I walk to the shivering, wild-eyed elf. She doesn't even protest as I lift her from the ground. The fear in her is exquisite, even more so than that of the companions now dwelling within me, sustaining me for now. I sit her back down on the picnic table, shivering all over, with the three flashlights by her side. She is discovered later that night, when the boys' parents come out to find them. By the next week, she is institutionalized. She really is such a nice girl. No reason to let her go through this alone, right? Taking her hand, I promise her that I will never leave her side again as she sits mutely in her two white room at the hospital. You've just heard me read The Battery by Rumor. Happy Halloween. This is Ms. G. I'm bringing you Telling Tales here tonight at 104.3 in Juneau, Alaska. I'll be right back with more. Stay tuned. Hello, this is Ms. G, bringing you Telling Tales. I hope you enjoyed that last story and are ready for another one. This story is called Victim, A Cautionary Tale for Vampires by Belinda Kay. Once a normal man, Anton Severin is now a creature of the night, condemned to wander New York between dusk and dawn. The gnawing lust for blood compels him to roam the city streets for sustenance. He stands in the deep recesses of the doorway to the old manse that once housed his family for 200 years. The dark purple shadows shield him from the final orange sliver of sun that finally drops behind the horizon, plunging everything into darkness. Having never felt compelled to usher his loved ones into that dangling existence between life and death, he stares into the darkness, remembering a century away. Simone, his wife of 1 year, is pitifully weak after travailing for hours. To him, her screams are blood dripping from every wall in the house. Unable to withstand another moment, he flees his home and the murder of crows gathered around his wife's birthing bed. He cannot tolerate the women with their mysterious midwifery. The crows bring Severin's only child into the world the same night he is cruelly snatched from the human race. A drunken dalliance with a woman he thinks a whore proves to be the literal death of him. She is Nosferatu, disease carrier. As the crows clean and swaddle the newborn infant and place him at the breast of Simone, Severin stumbles out of the old hotel and into the street. Red, thick blood fills the spaces between his fingers as he vainly attempts to staunch the flow streaming from his neck. The Nosferatu follows him. Her inhuman laughter fills the air, already heavy with moisture, and the sound seems to cling to his skin. He pleads, he begs, he prays, but to no avail. The Nosferatu is upon him just as he believes he has found safety in an alley. The gas-powered lamps throw long shadows against the walls of the buildings on either side of the alley. The Nosferatu shadow lengthens until it seems it will cover him completely. The thing whispers, "You will be mine." There is no time to scream. His eyes shine with tears as the slow-moving memories replay like an old movie reel. His cherished wife and child grow and old and die, thinking him dead. Tall, firmly built, his face angles in shadow, and he is aristocratic in his bearing, dark and brooding. The thick curls on his head are the color of raven's feathers and curve luxuriously over his long fingers as he runs a hand across his head. His mouth curves easily into a smile, exposing perfect teeth with canines that are only slightly longer than normal. His lips are full, the color of garnet, holding promises of eternal pleasures or eternal terror. But it is his eyes that capture and possess. They are deeply set and slightly wide apart and are black, fathomless, hypnotic, disquieting against the pale color of his skin. Severin no longer possesses a soul, but he knows grief. His long-dead loved ones still hold him in a woeful grip. He shakes off his memories, straightens his spine in preparation for the hunt ahead. Stepping from the shadows, he listens to his shoe heels echo through the empty streets. Rain has driven most of the human prey inside, and choosing wisely will be the cynosure of this night. The pavement shines beneath the street lights like black ice. He looks down, turns his heel. His body rises from the ground for the length of a man's arm, then returns. Flight is something that is not foreign to him, but he chooses to walk, to connect with the firmness of earth. As he nears a street, bright with the lights and noise of restaurants and nightclubs, he tilts his head up, sniffs the air. Human souls are gathered in these places. The rhythm of their hearts reverberate in his head. The scent of their blood is warm and inviting and makes the hunger yank ferociously at him so that he must briefly close his eyes, gain some control. He enters a small, expensive restaurant with few humans. He has made himself a valued patron here because the hunt is easy. The servers spy him at the door and clamor for his attention and the promise of a substantial tip. "Monsieur Severin, good evening, sir. Your usual table." The host is appropriately ingratiating. Severin condescends to give the host a slight smile and nod. As the two men pass through the dining room, several pairs of female eyes stare openly at him. He can almost taste the lust. The males, seated with their women, appear to pay little attention. However, he senses their discomfort, their envy, and anger. After settling into his chair, he snaps his napkin from the table, then murmurs, "My usual, please." Directly across from him, a woman sits alone at a single table, contemplating the glass of wine before her. He smiles. She looks startled. He orders a Merlot, the color of which is very much like his beverage of choice. The woman glances over at him twice more, and he captures her gaze. Her creamy skin takes on a light rose blush. She runs a delicate hand nervously over the tablecloth. Severin can almost taste her. The woman bears a strong resemblance to his beloved Simone, slight of build, chestnut hair that whispers across her shoulders, hazel eyes that are clear and guileless beneath pale brows. She gives him a nervous smile. Her lips are full. She even possesses a slight overbite. He must suppress calling to the woman by his wife's name. She lifts her head, and the tilt of her small nose is nearly arrogant. The smooth column of her neck is perfect. She will be his tonight. His server arrives, sets a plate before him. Steak tartare, sir. No spices, raw egg. At the exact same moment, the woman server returns with her order. The two eat in silence, occasionally stealing glances until the end of the meal when he plucks up his wine glass with two fingers, rises, and approaches her. He bows at the waist. May I join you? If you would allow, I would be eternally grateful to pay for your dinner. When she hesitates, he adds, I assure you, I have no ulterior motive. His voice weaves into her mind. I am no harm. She surprises herself by quietly agreeing, motions for him to sit. He sips delicately at the Merlot and watches intently as she enjoys a slice of chocolate cake covered in a rich chocolate ganache with a raspberry drizzle. He smiles at a small pool of red drizzle on her plate, then lets his gaze travel slowly until he sees the pulse at her neck, pushing her skin. When she finishes eating, he offers to walk her to her car because there are terrible things out there that go bump in the night. He places a hand against the small of her back and guides her outside. She points in the direction of her car, and the two stroll slowly, talking and laughing quietly. When they pass a darkened store doorway, he urges her into the shadows. He slips his hands into her hair, studies her beautiful face, and lowers his head to kiss her. His kisses are a practiced skill to give the illusion of spontaneous passion. She yields to him easily. His lips move from her mouth to the perfect column of her neck, at the spot of her pulse. She doesn't notice that his breath is cool and dry against her skin. She sighs quietly. So sweet. So perfect. He whispers just before his teeth pierce her skin. He blanches. Her blood is peculiar to his tongue. It is as if she is infused with an abrasive substance. As he swallows, the caustic scratches his throat and he coughs for a moment. He considers leaving this ill-tasting thing slumped in the doorway, but the hunger is too strong, and he continues to feed. Satisfied and sated, Severin shuts himself away from the rays of the dawning sun. After daylight surrenders its hold and night takes over, he prepares to hunt again. But this time, something is very wrong. He feels irritable. He feels angry. Unreasonably so. A dull ache travels across his abdomen. He rubs his hands over it, trying to ease the discomfort, and discovers with alarm that it is quite bloated. Though the large mirror in his room is useless to him, he can tell by touch that his face is bloated. This really annoys him. He searches his tall wardrobe for pants that will fasten around his middle so that he can move comfortably. He finally settles on an old pair of fleece pants with elastic in the hems that he removed from a male many months ago. When he slips the pants on, his ankles suffer from the pressure of the elastic. The running shoes he procured from the same male barely tie since his feet have swollen. This is unsettling. This is more than unsettling. It is infuriating. His fingers brush across his face. Sudden facial eruptions dot his forehead and nose. Skin complaint, he roars. This cannot be. He looks around. This horrible house annoys him. The lack of furniture annoys him. His family dying without his permission annoys him. He is startled by the sudden desire to eat chocolate and the overwhelming urge to hunt M&Ms. The vampire hurries into the night. The hunger for all things cocoa nearly drives him mad. He takes flight to the nearest late-night convenience store, grabs several large bags of M&Ms, and devours half before exiting. Using his mind, he convinces the clerk that the candy has been paid for. The clerk chuckles, "Hey, fella, take it easy on those." The creature, now condemned to wander the earth from dusk till dawn by the gnawing lust for chocolate, swirls around and shrieks, "Why? Do you think I look fat?" He hisses at the clerk before storming into the night. The clerk stares after the strange man in the tight fleece pants, clutching the M&M bags as though they were giving him life. Geez, he acts like he's got PMS. You've just heard me read Belinda Kay's Victim, a Cautionary Tale for Vampires. This has been Telling Tales with Ms. G, here tonight at KTOA 104.3 in Juneau, Alaska. Be safe out there and have fun on Halloween. Thank you.